This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi there, and welcome to Radio EcoShock. No doubt you've heard biologists and those darned environmentalists say we are already in the sixth great mass extinction. Animals and plants are disappearing daily. So in this show, we take a tour of a few past mass extinction events to see what they're like, with one of the planet's leading scientific experts on the subject. Then we'll explore a more direct problem. How will you make out if the electricity goes off for a while? What happens when the grid goes down? And can we ease the pain? All that and the ultimate solution to all of our problems this week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Why did 90% of all species living on Earth go extinct around a quarter of a billion years ago? Was this caused by global warming? We'll seek some answers from our guest, Dr. Paul Wignall. He's from the School of Earth and Environments at the University of Leeds in Britain. After decades of research and publications, Dr. Wignall is one of the world's experts on past extinctions. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So when did you start studying extinction events and why?
Quite a long time ago now, about 25 years ago, and the why is because they're interesting, but also at the time there was a lot of interest in the extinction of the dinosaurs that had been sort of rumbling on for a few years, and so I became interested in that, and then I thought I'd like to have a look at other mass extinctions, including the one you've just mentioned 250 million years ago.
Right. Now, before we get into some of those fascinating details about how unstable life is here on Earth, I have one quick question for our listeners. Does the study of the past really tell us anything important about the rapid warming humans are causing today?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we can only study the world as it is today, but if we look in a geological past, then we can see the way the world worked in the past and what happens when you have phenomena like rapid warming and rapid cooling and so on. So it's kind of a sort of experiments that have been run in the past, basically, and we can see what happened.
Now, you have studied rock formations and the fossils in them all over the world, from Poland to my own Canadian province of British Columbia. But I noticed, particularly after 2006, most of your papers are co-authored with Chinese scientists. Why is that?
Because they have similar research interests to me, but also there's a lot of, the appropriate rocks of the right age in China, particularly in South China. So I've done a lot of field work with Chinese colleagues in sort of southwest China in Yunnan province and Sichuan province and places like that.
So rocks are almost like a book. You go where the best and easiest to read book is.
That's right, yep. I've ended up traveling quite a few places in the world, but as you say, it's what you have to do if you want to see the rocks of the right age.
Now, your work has touched on a number of controversies raised by other scientists here on Radio EcoShock, and I'd like to start with your 2009 paper, Mantle Plume, the Invisible Serial Killer. What is a mantle plume?
A mantle plume is a sort of a structure or feature within the Earth, within the mantle, and it basically refers to sort of hot material that we think sort of wells up from the core, from the center of the Earth, and rises up to the just beneath the crust. And when it reaches the base of the Earth's crust, it then creates a lot of volcanism.
Now, what came out of that made it a serial killer?
It's mainly the scale. I mean, volcanic eruptions are sort of, the style of eruptions are sort of familiar in Hawaii today. So they're sort of basalt lava flows, but they're just much bigger than normally, these plume eruptions. So that rather than involving sort of, typically a lava flow will be a few cubic kilometers or a few cubic miles of lava, these are just orders of magnitude bigger scale eruptions.
Now, does that involve methane?
It does, but in a sort of rather complex, indirect sort of way. Volcanoes erupt out carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide and some other gases as well, and very little methane on its own, but we think that the eruption, particularly of carbon dioxide, triggers the release of methane. Do you want me to explain how we think that works?
Yeah, I'm interested because the Russian scientists, including Natalia Shakova, have suggested a 50 gigaton burst of methane could escape into the atmosphere, but I'm thinking that may not be connected to what you're talking about, is it?
No, not directly. I mean, there's not much methane comes out with volcanism, with volcanic eruptions, but there is methane trapped in places like permafrost and in beneath the ocean floor as well, which can be released particularly if you get warming started.
And I noticed that some scientists, including E. Haydari, disagreed with your mantle plume theory. Scientists do argue, don't they, even if politely, in journals?
Yes, we're not allowed to swear in journals, but we can have sort of quite strong arguments, I guess. You have to be careful. It's just it's the way you phrase it, really. But there's a lot of different ideas out there and quite a lot of competing theories, so it's almost inevitable that you end up arguing.
Now, Paul Wignall, you and your Chinese co-authors published another paper in 2012 that caused kind of a stir. You suggested Earth experienced lethally hot temperatures during the early Triassic greenhouse. What was lethally hot and when?
Yes, this is. It certainly was controversial, but I think we're right about this. We've recorded the warmest interval probably for the last billion years of Earth history. It's in the aftermath of this huge extinction 250 million years ago, and it seems that extinction coincided with warming, and we think the warming just got even worse in the aftermath of it, and so produced. Temperatures, we calculated sea surface temperatures rather than on land, but sea surface temperatures were approached 40 degrees centigrade at times, which is extremely hot, certainly well over 110 degrees Fahrenheit. So.
Well, that's hotter than our hottest baths. It's hotter than our own bodies. It's hard to imagine the seas being that hot.
It's true. It is very hard to imagine, and you're right. It's hotter if you could just about tolerate having a shower or a bath at 40 degrees, but only just. It would feel scaldingly hot. It's a bit sort of temperature of hot soup, really, I'd say. This is at the equator. We didn't say these temperatures were all over the world. The sort of equator temperatures were that, and we think actually at higher latitudes, the temperatures were probably quite normal. You know, it gets cooler towards the poles, and so the polar temperatures were not too bad. But certainly at the equator, we think it became lethally hot, and so it became impossible for many animals and many groups to live in equatorial waters.
In an interview for Naked Scientists, you said all forests were lost at that time, which is an amazing thought in itself, and it was a catastrophic time for insects as well. Could you tell us a bit about what happened to the trees and the bugs?
Yes, at the mass extinction itself, it's remarkable. It's the worst time that plants have ever had since they first colonized land. And so we see the loss of the dominant types of tree, which are gymnosperm groups, think like modern-day conifers and pine trees belong to these groups. But the ones around at that time, the main tree groups, families, disappear, as do a lot of the major insects around at the time as well. It's the only real crisis, severe crisis, that the insects have ever suffered. So just, if you like, it's a measure of just how bad this mass extinction was.
So what do scientists think caused this great mass extinction? I mean, it wasn't an asteroid, was it?
No, it's linked with, as we were just talking about, there's a gigantic volcanic eruptions in Siberia. We call them the Siberian Traps today, this region, and it's a huge area of basalt lava flows. And it's the gases that came out associated with those eruptions that we think did all the damage.
So this wasn't just a single event. It developed in stages. Could you talk to us about those stages?
Yeah, so we think the volcanism came out in a series of giant flows, and each flow would probably be several 10,000 cubic kilometers of lava, which is a gigantic amount of lava for one flow. And there's a whole series of these flows stacked up on top of each other. And we think particularly during the first few flows, there was also a huge amount of gas eruptions as well associated with them. And so, if you like, the lava is like a smoking gun, but is not the actual cause. I'm not sure if that works, that analogy. But anyway, it's not the actual cause of the extinction, but it's telling us we have a lot of eruptions, and it's the gas that comes out, which we have much less direct evidence of, that causes the actual extinction. So if you like, the lava tells us there was a lot of eruptions, and then we assume, like you usually have, there was a lot of gas came out with those eruptions.
Now, looking at that event and other extinctions you have studied, what species are most likely to recover quickly from an extreme heating crisis, and which ones may take a very long time to come back, if ever?
That's an interesting question. You can almost sort of predict beforehand what's going to recover quickly and what isn't. It's just that some groups evolve very quickly. So there's a group known as the ammonites, which sadly they're now extinct today, but they're a group of mollusks with nice little spiral shells. and they suffered badly during many extinctions. They don't do very well during many crises, but they bounce back very quickly, and so they evolve very fast indeed. And so we see those doing very well. There's other groups which sort of just plod along, and they don't evolve very fast at all. So in the sea, you have groups like the clams, or the bivalves, as we know them, and they do recover, but they're sort of much slower pace of recovery.
And you've talked about a lot of volcanoes blowing off, and I picture a lot of dust and dirt in the atmosphere and possibly a short-term global cooling. Did that happen, and did that stress life on Earth?
Probably, yes. This is one of the tricky things about understanding the full implications of volcanism. You're right. There's definitely volcanoes cause cooling because of all the gas and the aerosols that they produce. And that's very short term. It can be very severe, but it may only last a few years because the dust gets rained out of the atmosphere quite quickly. And that makes it difficult for geologists to spot. We're good at resolving things that happened over sort of thousands of years, but trying to spot something that just took a few years is very hard because you don't have much in the way of rock to look at for such a short amount of time. We think we're on firmer ground looking at longer-term effects like global warming, which do seem to last thousands and tens of thousands of years, and so leave a much more sort of tangible record in both the fossils and the rocks.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about past mass extinction events with Dr. Paul Wignall from the University of Leeds. Well, you've also published work on a different mass extinction, this time in the Middle Permian. Can you tell us when that was, and did species die off at that time due to warming or cooling, or what do we think?
Yes, there's a whole series of these extinctions. So the one in the Middle Permian was about 260 million years ago, and it has the same old culprit of a gigantic volcanic province, gigantic pile of lava flows, which are now in southern China. So we see them in China and just into northern Vietnam as well. There's similar sort of range of victims in the sea with lots of shellfish. Animals like brachiopods disappear at this time. The ammonoids have a tough time as well. So it's pretty similar to the extinction we were talking about, the slightly younger extinction 250 million years ago, except it's not quite as severe. It's not quite such a gigantic, if you like, catastrophe, but nonetheless it was a crisis.
Now, I'd like to move on to another theory about a crisis in the sea. Now, we've had author and paleoclimatologist Peter Ward as a guest several times on Radio EcoShock. His book, Under a Green Sky, affected me deeply. You published a paper in 2012 on green sulfur bacteria, and those seem to be the same agents that Ward suggested arose in oxygen-poor oceans, and maybe their hydrogen sulfide breath, if we want to call it that, may have caused mass death in land animals. What did you find, and does it correspond to Ward's theory?
Yes, I mean, these green sulfur bacteria is a sort of a marker for oceans which have gone, if you like, horribly wrong. So they've lost the normal oxygen which we find, which most oceans have most of the time. And so you start getting a different type of bacteria which produces hydrogen sulfide as a byproduct. And that's a pretty nasty gas, a dissolved gas in the sea, which kills off animals, basically. No animals can survive in the presence of H2S, hydrogen sulfide. So yes, it's certainly part of the extinction story. The understanding of it is how do the ocean get to that state? Why does it lose its oxygen? And I think that goes back to the factors like warming. As oceans that warm get less oxygen dissolved in them, and they seem to mix less well, and so it becomes they become poorly ventilated.
Now, a lot of this comes from one of your specialties, which is the study of anoxia, and that's a word seldom used by the public, although we've just been talking about it. What does it mean, and what does it tell us about the past?
Yes, anoxia is sort of, it's just lack of oxygen, basically. So we're all animals, all plants, we breathe oxygen, and we need oxygen, but you can have environments which where there is no oxygen available. You can find it in most sort of muddy seabeds. You can find it by digging. If you dig down into the sediment, you'll find the oxygen is lost, and you'll reach a layer of the sediment where it becomes anoxic. There is no oxygen available. That if you like, that's normal, but it becomes very sort of strange or sort of atypical if you start getting anoxic conditions within the water column. And then life's in big trouble. Then nothing can live on the seabed, and it becomes hard for animals swimming around in the water to survive. So it's that sort of open water anoxia which is really, really harmful.
Now, as you know, dead zones are popping up in the ocean around the world. We are generally told they're due to enriched runoff from the land Could there be other causes?
Yes, it's a whole sort of suite of causes that cause this. You're right, if the runoff from the land, essentially pollution, particularly sewage pollution into the sea, is a way of effective way of taking oxygen out. But also temperature is important. Warmer waters don't have as much oxygen in them, so that doesn't help either. And you can also get nutrients will supply from deep water can also produce sort of high productivity of plankton in the surface waters, and that in the long term doesn't help oxygenation either. So there's a whole bunch of factors. On a global scale, it's important for the oceans as how much sort of global mixing there is between the polar latitudes and the equatorial latitudes as well. And we think that that might decrease as the world gets warmer as well.
And I found something a bit like poetry, in scientific language, of course, in a paper you co-authored with Song and others. The title was Anoxia High Temperature Double Whammy During the Permian-Triassic Marine Crisis and Its Aftermath. And this paper talks about a narrow band where life survived between waters too hot and seas too low on oxygen. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that paper was about there's sort of two different stresses killing animals, but one working its way down from the surface of the oceans and one working its way up from the deep. And so, in effect, just leaving us a little band in between where it's kind of just about okay, I guess. So the depletion of oxygen usually occurs from sort of the seabed upwards, also the ocean bed upwards, whereas the high temperatures, which is also harmful, goes from sort of surface waters downwards. It gets the warmest waters at the surface and it gets cooler as you go into the ocean depths. And so both those lack of oxygen and high temperatures aren't good, but they act in different directions within the water column.
Now, Paul Wignall, I found missing from these papers, it seemed to me anyway, on extinction events, the so-called evil twin of climate change, namely ocean acidification. Is that because acidification is hard to study in ancient rocks?
Yes, it's a tricky thing to get at, is acidification. It may well be part of the crisis and the extinction story, but we have very little in the way of a direct measure of how acidic water is in the past. The problems for geologists, of course, the water itself doesn't fossilize. You just have the sediment that accumulated beneath it, and it is hard to, if you like, disentangle that factor. And also, it's hard to know which of the different sort of ways of killing things that we've spoken of. It's hard to know, are they all equally bad, or is one worse than the others? What's the crucial killing mechanism rather than just to say that, well, everything did it. It's quite important to know which is the most lethal, if you like.
So in the ice cores we get from Greenland, there's little bits of air trapped in the ice cores, but there's no equivalent of little bits of water we could study trapped in the rocks?
Sadly not, no. We have sort of indirect ways of getting at past ocean waters and looking at the various ratios of elements and things. But no, there's nothing too straightforward.
And looking into the dying ocean life in the past, you've also raised concerns about disappearing polar ice. Arctic and even Antarctic ice is melting rapidly now. If we lose that ice covering, what does your study of the past suggest that might mean for ocean life?
The simple loss of life, I guess there's two things that will happen. One will be sea level rise, which will be bad for mankind, anybody living in coastal regions. But that'll on its own, that's fine for marine life because that just increases the area of marine habitat. But it's a change in ocean circulation as a result of that. The oceans circulate today very well because it's very cold at high latitudes and much warmer at low latitudes, and so you end up with a conveyor of warm waters heading to higher latitudes, and you get this sort of deep cold water sinking from the poles, and so that type of circulation will decrease.
Now, these things about no ice at the poles, a stagnant ocean, that probably would take thousands of years, if not longer. Why should we worry about it now?
You're right. Yeah, I don't see this as an imminent catastrophe. The oceans, they're so huge of the oceans, and just changing the temperature of the oceans takes a lot of effort, if you like, a lot of energy to do it. So it happens on a hundreds of years to thousands of years scale. But nonetheless, on the way to getting to that sort of state, you will start to see the gradual onset of sort of harmful conditions. Certainly the areas in the ocean which are rather low in oxygen are beginning to increase, particularly in low latitude midwaters and so on. So you will start to see some of these effects. I don't think the sort of conditions, the sort of catastrophic conditions of 250 million years ago, I can't see that happening for, well, hopefully it'll never happen, but it's maybe thousands of years away from today.
Yeah, this is something that Dr. James Lovelock was talking about, was the possibility of stagnation in the oceans, and maybe we'd have to put pipes in to get the ocean moving again. But as we're saying now, that is a long way off.
It is. I mean, to get to that sort of stage, it's what happens in between, I guess. Do little sort of incremental changes in ocean circulation, will they be harmful or not? I mean, for me personally, I think the significant damage we're doing to the oceans today is all to do with overfishing and sort of just depleting fisheries and so on, which is obviously nothing to do with environmental changes. It's all to do with not managing fish stocks.
And what will you be researching next?
Next, I've got a couple of projects at the moment. I've moved back in time to have a look at the first mass extinction, which was 510 million years ago, and to see if that's, in fact, it's starting to look rather similar to all other mass extinctions, actually, but it's just to see how that sort of panned out and what happened in those times. That's one project. But also, I'm interested in the time after after the 250 million-year extinction, known as the end Permian extinction. There was then the subsequent sort of recovery in the next sort of 50 million years are rather fascinating. So I've been looking at, or just starting to look at that as well. It's a time when lots of modern groups evolve, like the mammals and the flowering plants, and the dinosaurs came along as well, of course. So it's looking at the sort of what controlled the appearance of the new groups after this big sort of wipeout at the end of the Permian.
And you're talking about controls, and one thing that I've wondered about, and so has Dr. James Hansen, is whether there is an upper limit on what happens in warming. You talked about one of the warmest times in the last billion years. Is there something that we know that can stop global warming from just taking off and perhaps blowing off our atmosphere?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think that the planet has a very good way of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which is essentially to do with just plant life and animal life, which takes up carbon, and some of that then gets buried in sediment, and so that's therefore carbon that's no longer in the atmosphere. And I think part of the reason that it became so bad for a short period of time after the end Permian extinction was because we've lost a lot of the normal ways of taking out carbon, such as the loss of plants and the loss of coal and burial like that. And that took a long time to recover, and so the Earth was just not as good at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere for that time. But nonetheless, it did. The Earth did sort of, if you like, pull back from the brink. It didn't get any hotter than 40 degrees C at the equator, and so therefore things recovered. And even when it was at 40 degrees C at the equator, it was actually, life was doing fine at high latitudes. You just end up vacating the equatorial latitudes for a few million years.
Yeah, Lovelock said we might be huddled up around the Arctic seas. Well, as we finish up, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
About mass extinctions in general? I mean, what we haven't mentioned, of course, is the debate on them in terms of other factors as well, which, for example, for the meteorite impacts, a lot of mass extinctions have the famous meteorite impact that did for the dinosaurs, of course, but other extinction events as well has been proposed. So there is a search on for the giant craters and things like that. But so far, I think the main culprit is volcanism and giant-scale volcanism. But even here, although I might have given the impression that every giant amount of volcanism causes extinction, there are still some fascinating times when we have giant volcanic eruptions and there are no extinctions. And so it's strange. The Earth sometimes responds to these giant eruptions, and at other times it doesn't. And we don't really know why that is.
Has the Earth settled down now that it's aged? Are we less likely to get such giant volcanic action?
No, there's no signs of it slowing down, but I think what we know, there hasn't been one for about 15 million years or so, but I don't think we need to worry about one in the near future. We'd be able to detect if there's going to be any sort of huge-scale volcanism coming, and I don't think there will be.
Well, good. Thank you. We've been speaking with one of the acknowledged experts on past mass extinction events with decades of research and many scientific publications in the field. Dr. Paul Wignall is from the School of Earth and Environments at the University of Leeds in Britain. If you want to dig deeper, you can find links to the papers, a YouTube video, and other articles in my Radio EcoShock show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
That's no problem.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Next up, when the grid goes down.
Got no water, got no food. God won't help you, but the devil would. When the grid goes down.
Though we barely heard about it, in January, Pakistan suffered the world's fourth largest power blackout. 140 million people went dark, including the capital, Islamabad, and the country's largest city, Karachi. It was a terrorist attack, and that's the very thing that has worried top regulators and power companies in America and in every Western country. Could a big country like the U.S., Britain, or Canada go dark? And if so, for how long? And what can we do to prepare? These are all questions that we're going to talk over with our guest. He's one of the bright young men in American power these days. Darren Hamill is the chief strategy officer and co-founder of Princeton Power Systems, and that's a company that specializes in bringing renewable energy online. Darren, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the solutions, and I know you have some, let's outline the depth of the risks we do face with these giant interlocking electric grids. What happened in Pakistan?
Sure. So in Pakistan, the attackers targeted a substation or multiple substations that kind of act as a central node on the grid. So taking out one of those substations can affect or will affect everybody downstream, which can be hundreds of thousands of people, depending on the size of the substation. That attack in particular was interesting because there was obviously intent to target that substation. We're more used to dealing in the U.S. with weather disasters that can have the same effect, but obviously come from a different intent.
But we did have one attack in Southern California on a substation that may have been terrorist. At least it was well planned and nobody's been caught yet. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. So sure, that one was sort of similar. It appeared as if the groups that were perpetrating that were kind of exploring what the effects would be. So it's maybe even more scary in that the effects were not as big as in Pakistan. But obviously, if that were to be replicated or scaled up, everybody that's connected to the grid is connected to substations at some point. And as they get more and more central, you can kind of target a single substation that could affect, you know, a very wide area. And that's the worry in Southern California, in Silicon Valley. Some studies have shown that, you know, a handful of substations could affect the vast majority of high-tech companies, not to mention residents and all the other buildings.
Oh, my gosh, not Facebook, not Twitter, please. The former the former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, John Wellinghoff, has been practically yelling about how poorly the electricity system is defended against terrorism now. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when we think about terrorism, to me, it also, again, comes back to the weather events, because they ultimately have the same effect. And some of the things that you would do to harden the grid are really the same. Chairman Wellinghoff was a really great advocate. He's obviously no longer the chairman at FERC, but I think it also goes to show the difficulty with changing the way that we think about the grid. You know, for all the advocacy that he did, not a whole lot has really changed in the past couple years. So it's going to take a while to build that momentum, get that message out, and really start to see some changes.
Well, and we have the specter of cyber attacks. We had Stuxnet in Iran that was designed by somebody to interfere with their nuclear systems. And all of our dams are operated remotely by computer. Our electrical systems are operated by computer. According to the Wall Street Journal, power companies reported 13 cyber attacks in just the last 3 years. I wonder how such an attack could work. Have you looked into that at all?
You know, one of the areas that we've looked into are nuclear power plants, obviously some of the largest single plants and with dangerous fuel and other things associated. And there's a stat that I heard was that at some point, every single nuke plant in the U.S. has been infiltrated successfully somewhat by cyber attack. It's not clear exactly what the perpetrators intend to do with the access that they get, but you could imagine, you know, the science fiction sort of idea of changing around a certain valve, messing with a certain temperature setting, and kind of getting the whole system to run into overload. Now, if you talk to nuclear engineers, that's really not, it's not as easy as it sounds. And there are obviously a lot of smart people thinking about that and trying to prevent it. But on the other hand, everything's getting more and more connected, and that's what the bad guys do, is look for those pieces that they can exploit. And it's really not always obvious what they're going to go for. So step one is to get access, and then step two is, you know, who knows exactly what they're going to do with that. And unfortunately, they have been successful with getting access.
And we have now terrorist groups like ISIS, which are showing they're pretty smart in using electronic media. And there's the report of North Korea hacking Sony, possibly. We're not sure about that one, but it can happen in the real world.
Absolutely. And especially you get these very well-funded groups, and it's just a matter of what they want to put the resources into. And obviously Sony, you know, that's a big deal, but can you imagine a section of the power grid? You know, there's hospitals and much more kind of critical infrastructure that could be damaged.
And then we have something that is a small risk in that it may never happen, but a huge impact if it ever did. And that would be an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, whether it comes from a nuke weapon blasted off in the atmosphere or from a solar storm. If we had a so-called Carrington event, the whole grid could go down possibly for years, some have said. Do you think that is a real concern or not?
You know, the idea with the grid that it is sort of centrally designed, where you can take out a single point and that can have kind of a ripple effect across the entire grid, is the way it was designed. So unfortunately, targeting some specific areas, you could have really massive effects. My personal opinion is that there are much easier ways to get those effects than through an EMP or a kind of a somewhat more complex mechanism. So we don't worry too much about that particular kind of attack, but the idea that you could attack one central location and have a pretty massive effect, whether it's by an EMP or just a physical assault on a substation like in Pakistan, that's probably a lot easier to do and unfortunately can have the same consequences.
Well, as you say, the best-known terrorists are the trees, the weather, and human error. We had that big northeast blackout of the United States and Canada in 2003. That darkened 55 million people. What caused that one? Do you know?
In 2003, I think that one was, it was actually more a matter of how the grid was sort of being balanced and regulated, and it was a cascading failure that started at a substation again with a relay switch, I believe, and that was more a case of where the way the system was designed, one kind of man-made error was able to cascade through a really long chain of events, and that's obviously a problem. You know, there's going to be human error no matter what we do, but there needs to be protections to isolate it. And that's kind of how the grid is designed. It's supposed to isolate itself. So that one, the kind of enormity of it was more a matter of almost kind of poor design and human error. But the idea that those relay stations can trip offline for any number of reasons, you know, that we have to expect that to continue to happen and just do a better job of preventing it from cascading.
Now, the four largest blackouts in the world all happened in Southeast Asia. The two biggest were in India and then Bangladesh, followed by the recent power loss in Pakistan. That India blackout of 2012 hit 620 million people. That's almost 10% of the world's humans. Are there particular reasons why that part of the world gets the big ones at this point?
Well, you know, unfortunately, that part of the world, even when it's not under blackout, the grid tends to be pretty unreliable. If you contrast like a system like where we're located, my company, we're in northern New Jersey, and we have what's called a networked grid. So there's a lot of power lines coming from multiple different generating stations and going into different neighborhoods, different distribution networks from multiple areas. So you're a little bit protected against one power plant going out. There's a lot of others that can kind of fill in for it. But if you look in the developing world, you know, it's been a challenge just to get any electricity to a lot of people, especially in kind of rural areas where it's pretty difficult to run power cables. So in some cases, you end up with one giant power cable coming from a central power plant. Taking out that one cable, that feeds hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. So it's a little bit of a matter of a less mature grid, and that's kind of fundamentally the case because you want to first just get access to electricity. So you want to invest almost the minimum that you can to make sure people are able to get electricity, and then over the years invest more in the hardening of that infrastructure. So it's just not quite as mature in most developing countries. And even in some places in the U.S. and other developed countries, different regions of the electrical grid are more susceptible to those kinds of outages.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Darren Hamill of Princeton Power Systems. We were talking about big electric blackouts and what we could do about them. So various politicians, Darren, have been talking about a new smart grid for America. Is that the answer, and will it ever come?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the smart grid has become a term that's almost been co-opted to mean a whole lot of different things. The general idea of upgrading the electric grid, kind of modernizing it, bringing connectivity and networking to the different substations, that all definitely needs to happen. And at a minimum, that'll make the grid much more efficient and make us use less fuel to provide all the electricity we need. Some people also think about smart meters at the home, kind of networked and connected meters to get people to maybe be more conscious about how much energy they use. Those are all good things. I think you don't necessarily need all this technology like smart meters in order to get consumers to take a little more control over their energy usage, but technology is going to, you know, it's going to proceed. It's going to make some changes. But also we think about the smart grid as being a more distributed grid. So instead of the idea that you'd have a giant coal plant in the middle of the U.S. and then electric power lines that go out to serve everybody, you end up with smaller distributed generation stations that are closer to where the load is. So first of all, that's more efficient. You don't have to transmit the electricity quite as far. But it also ends up being a little more resilient. To make that work, you do need to connect all of those generators up to the electric grid, and they have to communicate in a kind of a networked way. And so that's also another kind of way that you can define the smart grid. And I think both of those things are definitely going to continue to happen.
Now, you have another solution. It is the microgrid. Could you please define what a microgrid is and then maybe give us a couple of examples?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about a generating station that's closer to the load, even, say, a college campus, if you had a generator on a college campus, typically if you'd want to add maybe energy storage, ideally a renewable generation source, solar power, wind power, and then you tie those things together with all the local buildings, and you give that, quote, microgrid the ability to disconnect from the electric grid. So most of the time, you're still going to be connected up to the wider electric grid, but you have the ability to disconnect and generate all of your own power in one local area. So the term microgrid could be used to describe, again, say, a college campus. It could also be used to describe just a building like a Home Depot, a Walmart, or a hospital, as long as it has its own generating station and has the ability to disconnect from the grid. And so we tend to focus on microgrids that have a renewable component, because that's, again, another way to make the grid much more efficient. So some of the projects that we've done will include Alcatraz Island is a pretty famous example, where it actually used to have a connection to the electric grid, but it's pretty much disconnected all the time now and just generates its own power locally. So it consists of a large solar array, a battery bank, and then two diesel generators that are operated only when there's not enough solar power to power the island. And another couple examples, the U.S. military is doing a lot with microgrids. Down at Fort Bliss and Fort Carson are probably the best known examples. And these are systems that include solar generators, natural gas, diesel generators, large battery systems, large energy storage, and even the ability to charge electric vehicles, again, from a local grid that can disconnect from the utility, sort of whenever it wants to. But the idea is if there are terrorist events or other events that take down the bigger electric grid, these microgrids can continue operating.
And we have things like the big hurricanes, like Hurricane Sandy. If we'd had more microgrids then, we might have been better off.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a real eye-opener for people in our part of the world, that we actually had generating stations. A lot of people have invested in solar panels in particular. But when the grid goes down, these things don't operate. And people were pretty unaware of that. So there's a movement to allow those solar panels to install the technology that allows those to operate when the rest of the electric grid is down. And so you can imagine, even at the residential level, if you had a solar array, the grid goes down, but that solar array can still provide at least some kind of backup to your house. You know, at a minimum, you're able to charge your cell phones and keep some emergency lighting on. That became really important to a lot of people that hadn't thought about it before. Sandy in particular, but also, you know, in Connecticut and other places, they had a couple storms even before Sandy.
That could be tricky to implement, though. I'd like to do that, but the local provider says, well, no, you either have to be grid-tied or you have to be off the grid, but we won't let you do both.
Yeah, it's a technology solution, and the solution exists, but there is an educational piece trying to get local inspectors comfortable with it. So what we've done is there is a standard. It's an underwriter laboratory UL standard that will allow you to operate in an on-grid mode. So most of the time you're selling your solar electricity back to the grid. But if the grid goes down for whatever reason, that system is allowed to separate from the grid and then create a small microgrid at your home or at your building. And that's essentially what our equipment does, is it provides that off-grid solution, and then it'll actually reconnect back to the electric grid when it comes back online. So this is a technical solution that has been blessed by the kind of national regulators. So there's still an educational component to get more local permitting authorities comfortable with it, but there's no reason they shouldn't sign off on it since it meets all these national safety standards.
So if I'm a homeowner who wants that, where do I find it?
Well, you can start by checking out our website at princetonpower.com. And there are other companies that do similar things. The idea is it's a UL1741 compliant power electronics inverter. That's really the key. And then designing the system around that, you can add, you know, different kinds of generating sources. But that's the key, is you need a power electronics system that's UL certified and is capable of on-grid and off-grid, or sometimes it's called island mode.
I've got to find it. Well, I just saw an article about four homes in Missouri with rooftop solar panels and a microgrid, and the project was built by students and then set up by the Missouri University of Science and Technology. And it got me wondering, when do we move from this sort of pioneer mode of microgrids to a larger scale implementation?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the idea of operating off-grid, operating with solar, is obviously not a new one. It's been around for many, many decades, and people, really, really smart people, have been doing that kind of pioneering effort. But I think we really are at an inflection point, and again, Sandy was a big one for where we live in our area, where people have started investing a lot in solar, and there are a lot of deployments out there, but nobody realized that they didn't operate in this off-grid mode. So when that became apparent to people, people started asking the question, well, what would it take to do this? And at the same time, in parallel, the technology is there and the products are there now to do this pretty easily. So a whole key really is meeting these national code standards, because that makes everybody comfortable with much wider scale deployments. So we've done that, and I think the industry is there in terms of technology and products. And so now it's really about the education. If someone's going to invest in a local solar system, it's a pretty small marginal cost to make that off-grid, to make that a resilient solar system. So that's really the message that we're trying to get out there. And a lot of people are responding to it, but there is a lot of work to go to make it really a widespread thing.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Joseph Tainter, but he looked at the rise and fall of empires with an eye to fragility and complexity, and he says, when large empires become too complex, they break down, but they break down into smaller, more self-sufficient islands, and I'm thinking like the medieval fortress cities that operated as nation-states. I'm almost wondering whether this new need for microgrids doesn't reflect an uncertainty about the future of big systems. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. And, you know, kind of as a corollary to that, one reason that even utilities are investing in smaller distributed power plants is just that the speed and simplicity of getting those smaller plants sited, permitted, and built is just much, much easier than trying to build these kind of monolithic centralized power plants. So you end up with less complex, smaller generators kind of around the edges of the grid, And it's really kind of a natural, you know, market-based force that's making that happen, led by the technology getting much less expensive to put these power plants in a distributed place. But yeah, that's a really good point. So yeah, once you have those distributed power plants out there, the need for this really complex kind of command and control system goes away, as long as those distributed assets can communicate with each other and even disconnect from the grid if something does go wrong.
Darren, beyond PrincetonPower.com, can you recommend places where people can go to find out more about making our electric grid more resilient?
Sure. So Idaho National Lab actually just put out a really interesting study. I forget the exact name of it, but if you go to the Idaho National Lab page, I'm sure you'll find it there. NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, has done a lot of work with distributed solar and the technologies out there. And also the Rocky Mountain Institute is a nonprofit group that we've worked with that's recently published a really good report on the economics of what they call defecting from the grid. So that's sort of the extreme case where it's less expensive to generate your own power than it is to connect to the grid. So people may actually migrate towards their own kind of distributed systems. But that's a really good paper, the Rocky Mountain Institute website. I'm sure you can find it on there.
We've been talking with an entrepreneur with Renewable Energy Systems. Darren Hamill is with Princeton Power. You can find links to everything we've been talking about in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Darren.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Thousands of scientists met this past week for the annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS. On your behalf, I attended a couple of presentations for the press. I'm an accredited scientific journalist, after all. There were two big stories from an environmental point of view. The first was a study that finally tries to measure how many millions of tons of plastic waste end up in the ocean every year and where it's coming from. The second predicted a greater chance of a mega drought in the southwest U.S., a dry period lasting decades or even hundreds of years. That's happened in the past, and climate change makes it much more likely now. I'll put a link to those studies in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll be contacting the mega drought authors to see if we can line up an interview. As just a preview, here is a quick summary. By studying tree rings, soil samples, and other data, scientists found a series of prolonged droughts in the U.S. southwestern states and even into the central plains. These long, long dry periods reach from California, where so much of our food originates, through to the plain states, where again, a lot of food is grown or raised as meat on grasses. The last big drought in that area was in medieval times, so there are cycles possibly related to ocean conditions in the Pacific, which can bring about super droughts even without fossil fuel carbon going into the atmosphere. The chances of a long-lasting drought occurring in any one century are about 5 to 10%, as nature has it. But now with climate change, scientists have found the odds of experiencing a super drought in this century have risen as high as 80%. That's a very big chance that agriculture and maybe even some cities in the Southwest might have to be abandoned. As one of the authors, Toby Ault of Cornell University, pointed out, a glimmer of good news, and that's that the drought was not deep enough to kill off all the trees. Otherwise, they could not measure tree rings, in some cases going back thousands of years. The definition of a super drought is not that there is no rain at all, but that precipitation of all kinds drops back drastically for at least 35 years and possibly longer. Even if rains come, a hotter world means soils let go of their moisture at a greater rate as evaporation. Soil moisture is the critical factor for plant life and for species that depend on plants, like us. It's also a key to replenishing rivers and water reservoirs. The authors suggest that society build in planning and infrastructure for prolonged droughts, just as we do for things that have a big impact and maybe a lower risk, things like earthquakes in some states or hurricanes in others. With climate warming, drought has become a high-risk natural disaster. Find more links in my blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Now and then I get emails asking for more solutions. Fair enough. So this week, Radio EcoShock presents the ultimate solution for everything. Here is Murray Rees of Salt Spring Island in British Columbia, Canada.
I was scrolling through my inbox, deleting all the pleas for me to save the world from hunger, fracking, and disease with a click or a check or a quick signature. I came across one I'd never seen before. All the subject line said was, "Four more." I was curious. So I went to their website, where they laid out the facts with eye-catching charts, irrefutable stats, and cutting-edge animation. It awoke my slumbering moral indignation at the indecent injustice of our global situation. The unbridgeable gap between rich and poor nations, consumption of our planet's dwindling rations, and how we've let it get so preposterous that for the rest of the world to live like us, we'd need four more planets just bursting with stuff. I felt bad. Like I should give something away. Those chocolate truffles I just bought today. But they're like, come on, be honest, time to confess. How willing are you to settle for less so some total stranger you've never met can have a tiny fraction more of what's left? Didn't think so. But that's okay. We don't advocate austerity. Justice flows from abundance, not scarcity. No reason you can't keep your toys and all the rest of the world enjoy that standard of living we take for granted. Because if four more planets is what that takes, well, four more planets is what we'll make. The technology is not esoteric. We've got a killer crew of bio-geo-eco-hydrochemical mechanics. We'll terraform some asteroids, geo-engineer the moon. We'll have four more planets up and running real soon. Just click right here. You'll see what we mean. So I did, and was met by a dazzling scene. Four more planets, just like ours, strung like jewels between Earth and Mars. See, with four more planets orbiting the sun, it won't make any difference where you were born. Won't matter if you're red, black, yellow, or brown with four times more stuff to go all around. And soon as four more planets come to pass, 7 billion more members of the middle class with credit cards, tanks full of gas. Four more planets just like ours, every kid alive gets to drive their own car. And with four more planets in the firmament, we won't have to worry where the topsoil went, or the fish, or the forests, or the coral reefs. We'll get back all we lost, and more, for free. Four more planets, they'll even the score, between rich and poor, without blowing out our brains in resource wars. No more wars for water, or land, or oil, cobalt, tantalum, tungsten, or gold. Well, I was still taking in this stunning proposition for a system of cosmic resource redistribution when up pops four more planets mascot, crossed between the cutest little chipmunk and an astronaut. And he led us in a cheer to uplift our mood, and I want to lead you in this cheer too. Now, I'm looking out, and I can tell you've been to a lot of marches. You've been to a lot of protests. You know the drill. So I'm going to ask you, what do we want? And you're going to answer from the bottom of your heart with total conviction, four more planets. And then I'm going to ask you, when do we want them? Well, of course, we want them now. So what do we want?
Four more planets.
Yes. When do we want them?
Now.
Yes. Well, you know, it wouldn't be the net without a pitch. They started theirs off for the filthy rich. All you mega wealthy members of the corporate set, here's one tax write-off you'll never regret. Your cool $10 billion check gets you naming rights to a whole planet. But all you folks in the lower tiers, hey, your shot at posterity is just as near. And I'm thinking, Mount Murray, oh, that sounds nice. But for half the price, sparkling glaciers, all that sparkling ice. So let's all rest easy. Relax our minds. With four more planets, we'll get it right this time. And even if we run one into decline, We got another three just waiting in line. So what do we want?
Four more planets!
Yes, and when do we want them?
Now!
Yes!
Murray Rees is from Salt Spring Island in BC. He's a poet and activist with one foot in the printed page and the other on the stage. His collection, The Survival Rate of Butterflies in the Wild, was named the best first book of poetry published in Canada in 2013, and that's by the League of Canadian Poets. He performs as a solo spoken word poet and as a member of something called the Only Planet Cabaret. You can find a YouTube link for this performance of Four More Planets in my blog at ecoshock.info. Next week, we'll hear about climate change and crops in Europe, and famous climate scientist Michael Mann joins us. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. Of course, my weekly blog at ecoshock.info has lots of links for this program. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and for supporting Radio EcoShock. Here is more from the song When the Grid Goes Down, written and performed by longtime musician and composer Craig Anderton.
Either fight or die when the grid goes down.